We're continuing our series on life, death and resurrection. And just to give you an idea of where we're going with this, we originally looked at the fundamentals of life and death and resurrection as stated in the scriptures, as at least as I saw them, and I think most people here probably agreed with that. And then we looked at the timing of resurrection, and then we looked at the subject of hell, and Sheol and Hades and Gehenna. Hope some of this is coming back to you. And then we had our conference, and I gave two talks down there about Lazarus. And from that point on, really, we've been looking at individual passages that have to do with this subject, just covering some of those passages that I think are worth looking at, but we hadn't looked at them for some reason beforehand. And last week, we began just a little subsection of this series where we looked at the phrase absent from the body, present with the Lord, from 2 Corinthians 5. You needn't turn to it now, but there's a principle there. You may have actually heard people talk about, often at a funeral, they will say, well, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord, implying that once a Christian believer has died, that they then go straight to be with the Lord in heaven. And that, of course, is, as I tried to show last week, is not actually what that passage says at all. It doesn't even say to be absent from the Lord is to be present. To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. It doesn't even say it that way. Paul says, I'd like to be with the Lord. And then just at the end of last week's study, we also considered the phenomenon we know as near-death experiences. Near-death experiences. These are the sorts of experiences that people have often said they have, where they might be on the operating table, or they might be in some other precarious situation where they, in some sense, their body shuts down, or they might even be said to have died for 10 or 20 minutes, and they experience, or they come back to life again, and then they tell of going through a tunnel and seeing relatives, or even going to heaven, seeing wonderful things there. And we looked at that particular phenomenon too, and I did suggest to you that was not really consistent with the scriptures, that often people who have those experiences, they are not genuine experiences. They have the experience, they see lights and hear all sorts of things, but it's mostly a physiological thing, that the brain is playing a few tricks, and that the sorts of things they see are just about always to do with their background and their culture. So I mentioned that Buddhists who revere their ancestors tend to see a lot of ancestors in those experiences. I mentioned a man from Chile who lived in an area where there were lots of volcanoes, and there was a German community there, and when he died, his experience was that he went to a land with many volcanoes, and there was a German in charge, and he thought that was the afterlife. And of course, it's really just reflecting what was in his life. All right, so that was last week, and we've just started talking about this absent from the body, present with the Lord phrase. We've looked at, or considered all the way through this series, how people do not die and then go straight either to heaven or hell. They await resurrection, and resurrection has a timing, and it's not yet. We're going to look at Elijah tonight. Yes, we've already looked at the view that a believer does not go directly to heaven after dying, but lies unconscious in death and in need of resurrection, which will take place at a future time of God's choosing. So, in light of that standpoint, and regarding the believer's need for resurrection, we should ask, why was Elijah taken straight to heaven? All right, let's pick up the reading from 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 1. When the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha, now these are two prophets, in case you're not familiar with these people, two prophets, Elijah and Elisha, were on their way from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, the Lord has sent me to Bethel." But Elisha said, "As surely as the Lord lives, and as you live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. The company of the prophets at Bethel came out to Elisha and asked, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yes, I know," Elisha replied, "but do not speak of it." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, Elisha. The Lord has sent me to Jericho." We'll look at some of these places in a moment. And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So they went to Jericho. The company of the prophets at Jericho went up to Elisha and asked him, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yes, I know," he replied, "but do not speak of it." So he obviously wasn't that happy about it, or he's distressed by it, wasn't he? Verse 6, "Then Elijah said to him, 'Stay here, the Lord has sent me to the Jordan.' And he replied," that's Elisha replied, "'As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you.' So the two of them walked on."
Elijah wants to get rid of him, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Verse 7. Yes, thank you. Athel's just provided the key there. He's testing him a bit. Verse 7. 50 men of the company of the prophets went and stood at a distance, facing the place where Elijah and Elisha had stopped at the Jordan. Elijah took his cloak, rolled it up. Sometimes that says mantle in some translations, and it's not just a normal coat. It's a little bit special. We'll look at that in a moment. Elijah took his cloak or his mantle, his special robe, rolled it up, and struck the water with it. The water divided to the right and to the left, and the two of them crossed over on dry ground. When they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me, what can I do for you before I am taken from you?" "Let me inherit a double portion of your spirit," Elisha replied. "You have asked the difficult thing," Elijah said. "Yet if you see me when I am taken from you, it will be yours. Otherwise, not." In other words, if you don't see me when I'm taken from you, then that won't happen. Verse 11. As they were walking along and talking together, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses of fire appeared and separated the two of them, and Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. Elisha saw this and cried out, "My father, my father, the chariots and horsemen of Israel." And Elisha saw him no more. Then he took hold of his own clothes and tore them apart. He picked up the cloak that had fallen from Elijah and went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. Then he took the cloak that had fallen from him and struck the water with it. "Where now is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" he asked. When he struck the water, it divided to the right and to the left, and he crossed over. The company of the prophets from Jericho who were watching said, "The spirit of Elijah is resting on Elisha." And they went to meet him and bowed to the ground before him. "Look," they said, "we, your servants, have 50 able men. Let them go and look for your master. Perhaps the spirit of the Lord has picked him up and set him down on some mountain or in some valley." "No," Elisha replied, "do not send them." But they persisted until he was too ashamed to refuse. So he said, "Send them." And they sent 50 men who searched for 3 days, but did not find him. When they returned to Elisha, who was staying in Jericho, he said to them, "Didn't I tell you not to go?" And that's about all we'll read from there. Just want to make one point. We will look at some verses in that passage in the course of the night. There's one I probably won't talk about too much more, and that's in verse 9. Elijah and Elisha were both prophets, and Elisha requests that Elijah, before he goes, he says to him, "Let me inherit a double portion of your spirit." I must confess, I'm not absolutely certain of the mechanics of how that works, because Elisha was given the Holy Spirit to carry out his tasks and also to prophesy and so on. The one thing I can tell you about that is that of all the miracles that Elijah performed, Elisha performed twice as many. And that's, if you actually go through and count them all up, I can't tell you the number off the top of my head. You count them all up, Elisha had so many, and Elisha performed twice as many. I'm not exactly sure of the significance of that, but that's just something by the by. All right, now Let's have a look there. The key verse there, well, there's a couple of key verses. We're all in chapter 2 here. Verse 1, we read, when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind. So we read there that Elijah was going to be taken up to heaven in a whirlwind. And then the actuality takes place in verse 11. As they were walking along and talking together, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses appeared and separated the two of them, and Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. Now, do you have a bookmark? I hope you do. I'd like you to put it in 2 Kings. If you don't have a bookmark, I've got a few here. 2 Kings, and we're going to go to John chapter 3. And we'll just get a verse out of the way straight away. It's something that we need to look at immediately. John chapter 3. A rather profound chapter with many very interesting verses. We're just going to look at one verse. This is the Lord talking to Nicodemus, and there's some very interesting conversations going on here, but I want you to look at what the Lord says in verse 13. He tells Nicodemus, no one has ever gone into heaven except the one who came from heaven, the Son of Man. Now, we've just read that Elijah was taken up into heaven. And here, the Lord, some, let's say, 850 years later or so, says no one has ever gone into heaven except the one who came from heaven, the Son of Man. And, of course, this is the Lord himself talking about himself. So he should know whether Elijah went to heaven or not. And the problem comes, of course, when we consider that word heaven. Now, we're going to think about that word in just a moment. But we've just read there that no one has ever, at least at the Lord's time, no one had ever ascended into heaven. I'd like you to go over to Acts chapter 2 now. So bear that verse in mind.
He said he's gone up to heaven.
Who?
When did the Lord go up to heaven?
No one has ever gone into heaven except the one who came from heaven. I think that's I'm going to twist that a little bit. Has ever been in heaven. No man has ever been in heaven. And I don't think here.
Okay, so it's not.
I don't think that it's really saying that he. Well, I mean, in a sense, you know, the Lord's a unique being. In terms of his deity, he had sort of gone into heaven. I mean, it's not really the way that we think of it, because he came from heaven in this incarnation, in a sense. But I think if we read that in the sense of no man has ever been in heaven, I think, just to be a little loose with the translation, I think that's the sense of what's being said there.
But another thought there is, I mean, the Lord in what's called his, pre-incarnate appearances, there is a term, and that's not quite right. I mean, the Lord often appeared to people throughout the Testament, so he came and went back again.
Well, that's true too. Of course, so that has a problem with that verse too, because it says, except the Son of Man. Yeah, and he wasn't the Son of Man in the Old Testament.
No, true, but I don't think he ever appeared in. Never he appeared as a human.
Mm.
Was in that form.
Yes. And this is one of the problems, isn't it? When we try and apply some of the yes, and actually I'd like to actually look at some of these in about 3 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, say 3 weeks' time. We might try and consider the Lord's humanity in light of the things that we've been looking at. So I'll have to do a bit of reading before then, before we get to that point. All right, just to get us back on the track, we read in 2 Kings, Elijah was taken up to heaven in a whirlwind. Then we read in John 3, the Lord says, 800 or so years later, no one has ever ascended into heaven. So it seems to be a bit of a contradiction.
Is there any difference between going to heaven and going into heaven?
I think what we're going to find the difficulty is with what the word heaven means, okay? Let's have a look at another verse first, and then we'll get onto that. Acts chapter 2. Just trying to remind ourselves of some things that we know first, before we deal with these odd passages. And I think what often happens is that people take the odd passages like this, where it seems to say something very different to the testimony of Scripture, and they often make that the rule, instead of looking at all the things that we've looked at so far. I mean, how many hundreds of verses have we looked at in this series so far that say differently to that? And then this one kind of sticks out like a sore thumb, doesn't it? That we should consider this the exception in one sense. All right, Acts chapter 2, verse 29. This is Peter talking on the day of Pentecost. And he says, "Brothers." Yep. Okay, "Brothers, I can tell you confidently that the patriarch David died and was buried, and his tomb is here to this day." Now, that was about 1,000 years before, just roughly. About 1,000 years before. He says, "David died and was buried, and his tomb is here to this day." Now, go down to verse 34. This is still part of the same speech. He says, "For David did not ascend to heaven." David did not ascend to heaven. And later on, you needn't look at it, but in Acts 13, and I think it's verse 22, David is called a man after God's own heart. David is called a man after God's own heart. You'd reckon if anyone had died and gone straight to heaven, it'd be David. Because he was, you know, no one else is called a man after God's own heart that I'm aware of. There are some high acclamations of people in the Scriptures, and that's one of the highest. But we read there that David has not ascended to heaven. So, in a sense, what chance does anyone else have? And it just confirms that principle that we've looked at a number of times. A person dies, and then they are essentially, they are dead in every way until they are resurrected, and that is still future. So, the problem here is that we were told that Elijah was taken up to heaven, and that's exactly what the English word says, but that's not what the Hebrew says. Well, the Hebrew is perhaps a little vague. That's the word shamayim. Heaven is the word shamayim. And it's used interchangeably. It could mean the abode of God, not the very highest of heaven, if you like. It can mean the stars. So it's things that we can see but we can't really touch or get to. And it can even mean, in fact, is often used to mean the sky, just where the birds are and the clouds, and it's quite reachable. It's really anything that's not earth is heaven. Now, whether that's heaven we can't see, where God lives or abides, whether it's space, the stars, the moon, so on, whether it's just the sky here where the birds are, it's anything that has been heaved up. I mean, that's where we get the English word from, heaven, heaved up. It's up there, it's not on the earth. And in this case, I think Elijah was taken into the sky. Again, just bear with me here. I've got a few verses for us to look at, but that's, I think, what happened. When we read Genesis 1:20, you needn't turn to it, but we read that fowl or birds fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. And that's the sky. They don't fly in space. They don't, yes, okay, but they don't fly in space, and they don't fly in places that we can't see, where God lives. They fly just above here. I mean, if you walk outside in daylight, you'll see birds flying around. It's just there. And that's exactly the same word, and it's used quite a number of times. So it's actually occasionally unclear as to which meaning should be applied. And here I'm suggesting that Elijah was taken up into the sky by a whirlwind, by the way, not a chariot of fire. We'll look at that again in a second. And I think he was actually taken up, and I think he was placed down on the earth somewhere else. And I've got an idea where that might have been. We'll look at that in a moment. Let's go back now to... Don't go there. We're going to Acts again, because I wanted to give you an example of where someone was taken away and put down somewhere else in a strange way. Let's go to Acts chapter 8. The verse is going to be around about 39, towards the end of the chapter. So what I'm going to suggest here that happened was that Elijah was moved from one place away from where Elisha was, and he was put down somewhere else. Not put down as in killed, but he was placed down by the whirlwind somewhere else. He moved from one place to another. Now I want you to consider how the apostle Philip was taken away by the Spirit. And we'll read here verse 36. Now Philip's talking to a man from Ethiopia here. And it says, as they travel along the road, they came to some water, and the eunuch says, look, here is water. Why shouldn't I be baptized? And he gave orders to stop the chariot. Then both Philip and the eunuch went down into the water, and Philip baptized him. When they came up out of the water, the Spirit of the Lord suddenly took Philip away. And the eunuch did not see him again, but went on his way rejoicing. Philip, however, appeared at Azotus and travelled about, preaching the gospel in all the towns until he reached Caesarea. Now, it's a little uncertain where these places are, but we think that Azotus was about 20 miles away from Gaza, where these people were talking. So just in the middle of their conversation, the Lord said, all right, your work's done here. I'm going to pick you up, and you're over there. Well, in fact, you need it over there. 30 kilometres, 20 miles up the road there. And he was gone. And as it says here, the eunuch saw Philip no more. Philip's work in that place with that man was done. And
I think that's probably the mode of transport during the millennium.
Well, it may be. It may be. It may be. We're not sure. And this is what I think happened to Elijah. So I'd like you to turn back now to, to 2 Kings. Where you should have your bookmark. Did you notice there in, I hope you're in 2 Kings 2 now, verse 1, it says, when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, and then it says something similar in verse 11. It says, as they, that's Elisha and Elijah, as they were walking along and talking together, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses of fire appeared and separated the two of them, and Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. Have you ever heard the song, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot? Coming for to carry me home. That's about this, but it's wrong. It's wrong because Elijah was not taken by a chariot at all. He was taken up by a whirlwind, and he wasn't taken home, quote unquote. He wasn't taken to heaven. I think I can prove this pretty emphatically in a moment, that he didn't go to heaven straight away. So it always pays, doesn't it, just to read the words carefully. He was taken up by a whirlwind and put somewhere else.
So the chariot was basically just to separate him from
the chariot. Exactly, the chariot of fire, the horses of fire, it says it separated the two of them. If Elijah had gone up in a chariot of fire, he would have been burned to death. Right? That's what fire does in the scriptures. It either makes someone more pure, but not a literal fire. Literal fire never makes anyone more pure. Literal fire just burns people. It incinerates them. So that wasn't what took place here. It separated them. Except Daniel, correct. But he was protected from the fire, wasn't he? He was protected from the fire.
It wasn't burning the horses, was it?
No, they were horses of fire. I mean, these are spiritual beings here, in some way, rather unusual, but there we have it. All right, now what I want you to do now is keep your bookmark there in 2 Kings 2, and I'd like you to go forward a couple of books to 2 Chronicles. So the next book is 1 Chronicles, and I want you to go to 2 Chronicles, chapter 21. And I'd like us to have a look at verse 8. We'll read a few verses from verse 8. Now, don't worry about all the names here, the kings and so on. I'll show you where all these people fit in just a moment. Let's just get the general thread of what's happening. Verse 8. In the time of Jehoram, Edom rebelled against Judah and set up its own king. So Jehoram went there with his officers and all his chariots. The Edomites surrounded him and his chariot commanders, but he rose up and broke through by night. What's all this got to do with Elijah? Keep reading. To this day, Edom has been in rebellion against Judah. Libna revolted at the same time because Jehoram had forsaken the Lord, the God of his fathers. He had also built high places on the hills of Judah and caused the people of Jerusalem to prostitute themselves and had led Judah astray. What we need to realize here, just for a moment anyway, is that Jehoram is the king of Judah. What's Judah? Well, this is the time where we have two kingdoms. We have a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. And Jehoram, this particular Jehoram, there was a Jehoram king of Israel as well, not too much earlier, but this Jehoram was the king of Judah. And we read in verse 12, Jehoram received a letter from Elijah the prophet, which said, "This is what the Lord, the God of your father David, says. You have not walked in the ways of your father Jehoshaphat or of Asa, king of Judah, but you have walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, and you have led Judah and the people of Jerusalem to prostitute themselves, just as the house of Ahab did. You have also murdered your own brothers, members of your father's house, men who were better than you. So now the Lord is about to strike your people, your sons, your wives, and everything that is yours with a heavy blow. You yourself will be very ill with a lingering disease of the bowels," "until the disease causes your bowels to come out." Not pleasant. Now, there's a lot in that passage. If you didn't understand a word of it, just bear with me, because I'll explain a little bit. All right, let's go back a step. This is a map of the divided kingdom. This kingdom moved, the borders moved a little bit over hundreds of years, but essentially this will do for our purposes. We have the northern kingdom of Israel, you can see the word Israel there, and the southern kingdom of Judah. So we had, this was all united under Saul, David and Solomon, and then after that we had a succession of kings who were ruling over Israel and kings who were ruling over Judah. Okay. Now, let's go to Jehoram. Have a look at this. Here's all the kings of Israel, and here's all the kings of Judah. There's the kings of Israel. Not all of the kings are listed there, but there were 20 kings of Israel, and there were 20 kings of Judah. You could argue 19 in some cases, but let's just say 20 each. All the kings of Israel were baddies. Every one of them, all rotters. They all followed after idols. They all worshipped false gods and led the people astray. The kingdom of Judah fared a little better, though not much. Out of the 20, 8 of them are said to have followed the Lord and been pleasing to the Lord at least part of their lives. I think there's only about 4 or 5 of them of whom has said they followed the Lord all their life. Now, where's that lead us? Asa and Jehoshaphat were basically good ones. We read about them in verse, this is part of the letter, verse 12. So Elijah sends a letter, and he says, "You've not walked in the ways of your father Jehoshaphat or of Asa, king of Judah, but you," so this is Jehoram here, "you have basically led the people astray." Let me cut to the chase and then we'll go back and fill in the details. This is when Elijah was taken from Israel during the reign, I think it's just after the reign of a king who only lasted about 2 years called Ahaziah. And then you'll see there's another Jehoram, this is the king of Israel. He was taken round about, let's say, roughly 850. Figures are a bit rubbery. This letter that we read of here was written about 10 or 15 years later. So if Elijah was taken to heaven, never to be seen of again, how did he end up writing a letter 10 or 15 years later to another king? Well, the answer is, I believe, that Elijah was not taken to heaven at all. He was picked up, taken away, and put down somewhere else, where he continued a ministry in some way, and part of his ministry was then to write this letter to Jehoram, the Jehoram king of Judah. Anyone completely lost yet? Or want to ask a question or clarify something? The timing is a little tricky, but essentially Elijah's, all the events in Elijah's life in 2 Kings that we read about, you know, he confronts the prophets of Baal and calls down fire from heaven, and he raises a widow's son, and all of those things that we read about happen at this point on the chart beforehand, particularly during Ahab's reign. Ahab hated Elijah. Elijah had nothing good to say to Ahab, well, virtually nothing good to say to Ahab. And so that was when he ministered. And at this point, it's because there's another king who ended up being in power there called Ahaziah, and at that point Elijah was taken. Now, where was he taken from? He was taken from Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel. A lot of what we just read there at the beginning of 2 Kings, you remember, he went from one place and Elijah said, I want to come with you, and he went to another place and another place and another place. All takes place towards the south here, but it's in Israel. And where at the Jordan, that's where Elijah was taken. And then what we read here 15 years later is, if you have a look at verse 8. I hope you're in 2 Chronicles 21 still. Verse 8. In the time of Jehoram, that's Jehoram the king of Judah, the south, Edom, here's Edom on the map, way, way, way down south, Edom rebelled against Judah and set up its own king. So Jehoram went there, he would have gone, he was probably based in Jerusalem, he went down to Edom, down here, still in verse 9, Jehoram went there with his officers and all his chariots. The Edomites surrounded him and his chariot commanders, but he rose up and broke through the night. Let's just go down to verse 12. Jehoram received a letter from Elijah the prophet, and this is really where I believe he was. This is where I think,
where
Jehoram was and where I think Elijah was, yes. We're not really certain where Elijah was. He was down here somewhere, because he sent a letter to the king who was down here. Those intervening verses, verse 10, talk about Libna, and Libna's over this way. So it's just really saying, also at the same time, there's another area that rebelled. But the king was down here, and this is where Elijah sends a letter to him. Any questions or comments so far?
It just says that in the second Kings, it's not mentioned. You know,
no, that's right. That's right. Because that particular part, well, yeah, no, it's not really a parallel passage. It's not really a parallel passage, because the book of Chronicles is entirely, when we get this divided kingdom apart, it is entirely concerned with the south kingdom of Judah. So we read in detail about all the kings of Judah. We only read scattered information about the northern kingdom of Israel. So we get, in a sense, a complete or a sequential history of Judah. We just get snippets of information about Israel. That's in the book of Chronicles. The books of Kings, you get a bit of both. And what I'm essentially saying here is that Elijah was a prophet of the northern kingdom of Israel. He was then taken by the whirlwind. Elisha saw him no more, and he ended up down here as a prophet. Not a particularly significant prophet, obviously, because he doesn't turn up too many other places. Well, that's right, but he seemed to be, if you like, the head of the prophets, or he had a very, very major role in Israel up until 2 Kings 2, and then he's taken away and probably placed down here, I think. I'm not saying there's not gaps with this idea, but I think that's what happened. Because this letter, definitely, the time of this letter is pretty certain. It is about 10 to 15 years after he was taken away. Any questions or comments?
Oh, David, I've just tried online. Up. Going back to 2 Kings and 17.
Mm-hmm. Let's go there now, folks. So let's get all the same place here. We're in 2 Kings chapter 1.
Yeah.
verse 17.
And it's just the verse 16. And he had no son, Jehoram became king.
That's right. This is what makes it complicated. It's a different Jehoram.
Yes, and I'm trying to king in his place. Second year of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. Well.
All right, so let's just unravel that a bit. It's a really good point. All right, Margaret is looking at 2 Kings chapter 1. It gets a bit complicated here. This is a side issue, but it's worth looking at. Verse 17. We're talking about Ahaziah. So Ahaziah is just in that little slither on the chart there, after Ahab, before Jehoram of Israel. So he's there. And then we read in verse 17, so he died. So that's Ahaziah there. Ahaziah died according to the word of the Lord that Elijah had spoken. Ahaziah had no son. Joram, that says in the NIV, that's another word for Jehoram, the next king, who is on our chart. Jehoram succeeded him as king. And this is where it gets complicated. In the second year of Jehoram. So they're comparing it, to give you an idea, they're comparing it with the king of Judah. So it's down here. So that's perhaps a little skew if they're on our chart. So we've actually got two Jehorams reigning at the same time. We've got a Jehoram in the north and Jehoram in the south.
So was that Jehoram up the north, the son of Ahab?
No, he was the son...
Who was ever in the middle of
the
one?
No, there was Ahaziah, but Ahaziah had no son. So it says Jehoram succeeded him. Just to settle this, just confuse the issue. All the kings of Judah, just about all of them, not all of them, but just about all of them, were descendants of each other. So you get the son of, the son of, the son of, the son of, the son of. It's, you sometimes get a nephew or a grandson in there, but it's essentially a family line. That didn't take place in Israel. I think there's a couple of them who are sons of the one before, but essentially, they all got killed by their enemies and rebels, and the new family line came in. If you know anything about British history and the royal history, it's something very similar, really. There was you get a family that lasts for a couple of generations and another family. Yes, so this is the other Jehoram here. Some of the details here are not crystal clear, but what I really want you to take note of, and this is the main point, Elijah, when he was taken... then he didn't go to heaven and disappear off the face of the earth. He turns up 10 to 15 years later and writes a letter to the king in Judah. Okay? So he was a prophet of Israel. He became a prophet of Judah. Oh, and the other thing I should note, you've probably gone from 2 Chronicles 21 now. I'll just read some of this for you. Did you notice that in Elijah's letter... he mentions Ahab a few times. Now, Elijah was perhaps the main prophet who dealt with Ahab. If you're going there, it's in 2 Chronicles 21, and we're looking at verse 13. Right, Elijah is talking now. He's sent this letter, and he's talking to Jehoram, the king of Judah. He says, but you've walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. And you could almost insert in there, whom I've had a lot to do with. And you have led Judah and the people of Jerusalem to prostitute themselves, just as the house of Ahab did, whom I also had a lot to do with. Now, I'm just inserting that, but this is Elijah talking. And then he talks about some other nasty deeds there. So this particular Jehoram who's receiving this letter 10 or 15 years later is a king of Judah. And what's being said to him essentially is here... you didn't do what you didn't walk in the good ways your fathers did, your other kings of Judah. You're walking like one of the kings of Israel, who were all bad, who all led their nation astray. Let's just say, I've suggested, as most commentators do, that this time is around about 10 to 15 years later. Check a number of chronologies, that doesn't make them absolutely correct. Let's even say it's 1 year later.
If it's later at all.
It's later. He wasn't taken up by a whirlwind into the abode of God and is now with God. This is the point. But he turned up later elsewhere and he turned up in Judah. Instead of being a prophet of Israel, he's now a prophet of Judah. And just to finish off our study, this is really what I just want to consider. Have you ever thought about why he was taken? We focus on the fact that he was taken. We focus on the fact that Elisha was there and he carries on. I've brought to your attention, or just reminded you, that he turns up somewhere else. But why did all this happen?
And it's puzzling why that everyone seemed to know that he was about to be taken.
Yes, they knew. All the prophets said, Elisha, do you know your master's going? Don't mention it.
So there's no explanation for that?
Well, I think there's a little bit of an explanation. I'm going to offer an explanation anyway. His ministry to Israel was finished. All this time, Elisha was the junior prophet, if you like, the head prophet in waiting, and he was being groomed to take on the role. And once Elisha was ready, Elijah was taken out of the scene. Look, you're needed somewhere else. Just like on the road in Acts, when Philip was dealing with the eunuch, Philip had to be there at that time to deal with that man in that particular way. And when he was done, the Lord said, your work here is done. I'm taking you off and I'm putting you down there. It's the same thing. I believe it's the same thing. Let's have a look at... I made a point about the cloak, and I just want to make a point about that. Let's go back to 2 Kings chapter 2, if you're not already there, and we'll finish this with these few points. Now, keep your bookmark there, because we do have to go to one other place in the interim. We read in 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 3, the company of the prophets at Bethel came out to Elisha and asked, do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today? So Elijah was Elisha's master. If you like, Elisha was sort of a disciple, a follower. Not necessarily, he didn't worship Elijah, but he followed him. He was under his tutelage, under his care, however you want to put it. So there, he was under... He considered Elijah his master. Also, verse 5 says something similar. The company of the prophets at Jericho went up to Elisha and asked him, do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today? And yes, he did. Now, what took place after Elijah was removed was that Elisha was going to assume this role of the prophet, the main prophet here. And I think this is signified by the cloak, the mantle that we read about. Have a look at it in verse 8. We read that Elijah took his cloak, took his own cloak, his own mantle, and that's not the same word for just a coat that someone wears. It's from the Hebrew word adereth, and it has the idea of a robe of magnificence. The idea of magnificence is in there.
A bit like Joseph.
A bit like Joseph. It's a different word, but it was a special robe. So the word adereth actually is used to describe glory and magnificence elsewhere. Here it's described as a robe. So it wasn't an ordinary robe. It was a pretty special robe, if you like.
A cloak of office.
A cloak of office, yes, that's a good way to put it. So Elijah took his cloak, verse 8, Elijah took his cloak, rolled it up and struck the water with it, and the water divided to the right and to the left. Sounds like Moses, doesn't it? And the two of them crossed over on dry land. Have a look now, verse 13. Now, by the time we get to verse 13, Elijah had been taken away. Elijah's gone up in the whirlwind, and Elisha had seen him no more. Verse 13. He picked up the cloak that had fallen from Elijah and went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. Then he took the cloak that had fallen from him and struck the water with it. Where now is the Lord, the God of Elijah? He asked. When he struck the water, it divided to the right and to the left, and he crossed over. And essentially, I think that Elijah's role, his office, if you like, was being passed on to Elisha here.
When he called Elisha, he put his cloak on Elisha.
Yes, he did that too. That's right. Yes, that's earlier on, isn't it? Yes, and that's in, I'd like you to turn to that, that's in 1 Kings 19. 1 Kings 19 and verse 13. You're getting a bit of conditional immortality in history tonight. verse 13. There was an earthquake and all sorts of things are happening here, but just to get the idea about the mantle and the cloak. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. And the Lord says, what are you doing here? Then we go down to verse 19. It says, so Elijah went from there and found Elisha, son of Shaphat. He was ploughing with 12 yoke of oxen, and he himself was driving the 12th pair. Elijah went up to him and threw his cloak around him. And there's quite an interesting little play between the two there. But essentially, when this is a part that describes how Elijah, he fled, and he didn't know that there were actually 7,000 other people who were following the Lord. And where had he fled from? Well, he'd fled from the north, and he ended up down, well, he was at Horeb, wasn't he? Which is, that's Sinai. That's way down, it's not even on the map here. He was down here somewhere. He was in the wrong spot. He wasn't where he was called to minister at all, which was up here. He basically ran away. He did a little bit like what Jonah did, perhaps a bit different in some ways, but essentially he did not want to be where he was supposed to minister. And so he's a little bit ashamed actually here. He said, I'm not worthy, and anyway, that's how I see it. It's a long way. Mount Sinai is the base of that triangular piece of land. It's a long, long way away. Anyway, he goes back and carries on. I think that's about all I want to do tonight, just to finish up by saying that there's still questions that can be raised about the fate of Elijah, but I think the suggestions here, well, I think they hold up well against the orthodox views, and that's that believers don't go straight to heaven after death, but the hope of the believer lies in resurrection. And that when we consider these issues, we should look at the general patterns and become familiar with those general foundational doctrines about God's dealings in life, death and resurrection. And then we put those other one-off situations into those. That the rare and the odd and the unusual events, and to put them into there. So, sorry, a little technical there tonight, but I hope that was of some interest, and hope it might have given you some sort of answer with that anyway. Ultimately, of course, I hope it glorifies the Lord and does his name justice.